It's a pachad to speak about somebody as great as Rebelsky, Zichron Lebracha. It's a very scary thing. Gemara says the Hasam came, the Nifter is there at a hesped. So we won't call this a hesped. We'll call it Divrei Zichron. I spent some time with Rebelsky for a few summers. A long time ago, I kept up with him a little bit, and he definitely changed my life. That's certain. Just a few words about talking about a Gadol B'Yisrael. There's a taina that's out there on art scroll books. Gedolim stories, that when we hear a story about the Vilna Gaon, the Vilna Gaon was new Kalatar Kula and made a Gaelim before he was Bar Mitzvah and etc. and so forth, and you hear all the stories about the Vilna Gaon, so you start saying, so the Maisa, for me, I can't do any of those things. That's not for me. So it's depressing. I hear stories about the Vilna Gaon, and I hear stories about the Chofetz Chaim, what a tzaddik he was. Not for me. I can't do that. And Mela, it's not a good idea to hear stories like that. It's not a good idea to read books like that. Because when a person reads books like that and hears stories like that, then they feel like it's unattainable. It's unreachable. It's not possible for me to be that. And it has the opposite effect of what was intended. A lot of people say that the books should be written about people that were regular people, quote-unquote, with regular types of minds, to see how far they went, because that's more similar to what we are. But B'mechilas Kfar, the people who say that taina, I think the taina is absolutely incorrect. I think it's an incorrect taina. And if you just look around at the world around us, certainly at the Goyishal world around us, Havdil, the Jewish world around us, if you look around, you see that that's not the way people act. The Taina is a good Svara, there's a good Svara to that Taina, but it's incorrect, it's not correct. I haven't yet met a kid on the basketball court who doesn't think that one day he'll be in the NBA, who doesn't say 3-2-1, he's going to hit the last shot just like... You can finish the sentence just like whoever. I haven't met a kid on a baseball diamond who doesn't think he's going to be the shortstop in the bottom of the ninth inning, etc. We're inspired by greatness. We're inspired by greatness in a secular way. We're certainly inspired by greatness in a teredika way, lahatu. We're inspired by greatness. It makes us work hard. None of us are 6'8", 280 pounds, can't dunk a basketball, doesn't stop us from playing. Just the opposite, those people inspire us. If you didn't have those wonderful dugmos, not sure 100% that we'd be able to have the kochos to get through a basketball game, Baruch Hashem. So I don't think the time is a good time. I think when you see the godless of Torah, the Romimus of Torah, the Nitzchius of Torah, it doesn't make you give up. It makes you realize there's so much there and there's so much to strive for. Okay? Our IQ is not necessarily the IQ of some of the Gedolim that we talk about. Our Koyach is not necessarily their Koyach. But if we know how much there is out there, and that someone with such an IQ would spend his whole life doing that, there must be something very chashuv to it. How many of us sat down and played a game of tic-tac-toe? How often did you play? And at what point did you realize you're wasting your time? Because there's no tachlis to the game. 10 minutes after you started playing, you realize there is no tachlis. But when you sit down and you play a game of chess and you see that there's chachma behind it, that's something you can play for a long time. You see there's chachamim that are involved in it. When we talk about the godless of Torah, even if the person is way beyond what we are, way beyond, it makes us want to be part of that. We want to be part of that. We want to work with that. Rabbi Tzuk Shaina, the Kamenetzker of Shiva, spoke today in Yerushalayim, and he said, B'Shem Rabbi Yashiv, that Rav Belsky knew Kol HaTorah Kula. Anybody who knew him, that was very obvious. There wasn't an area of Torah that you could talk to him about without any preparation that he couldn't speak about for hours and hours and hours. There wasn't an area. Rav Belsky used to sit in the summer in Camp Aguda, he used to sit in the afternoons, and he used to have his chevra around him, those were the masmidim. That's what they were called, the masmidim. And we used to ask any question that we wanted about any part of Torah, in hashkafa, in halacha, in lamdas, and he would sit for an hour and a half, every single Shabbos afternoon, and answer. And the questions were so wide and so varied, it was unbelievable. Rebelsky was a Persik for the OU. Whenever the OU had a conference, Rebelsky used to sit on the side. Whoever the speaker was the speaker, and he gave a speech. But when the questions started coming fast and furious, and the speakers couldn't answer the questions, Rebelsky was sitting there to answer all of the questions that no one else knew the answers to. My father spoke at an OU conference a few years ago. It was a conference about removing chelev, nikur. And a fellow came to speak, and he brought the leg of an animal, and he was showing how you remove the chelev from the leg, what's the chelev, what's not the chelev, and how you remove it from the leg. And somebody stood up in the audience and asked, where's the gira nosha? So it was a little quiet from the front of the room, and Rebelsky was sitting on the side, and Rebelsky sat on the side, and he said, it's an excellent question. That's the foreleg of an animal. Gira nosha is not in the foreleg of the animal. Nosha is in the back of the animal, right? Rebelsky, what's the Metzias? There wasn't the Metzias that he didn't know. I grew up in a house that was filled with Torah. It was filled with Torah. The Shabbos table in my father's house was a Shabbos table that was just filled, all was called Kulei Torah. But nothing prepared me for showing up to Camp Aguda. I grew up in Queens. I was a modern kid in Queens, New York. And all of a sudden I was dropped into the middle of Borough Park, in the mountains. It was Camp Aguda. Rebelsky did an amazing thing. There were learning camps, and there were fun overnight summer camps. But Rebelsky went ahead and he said that we're not going to have learning groups in a camp to potter the learning that everybody needs to do for the day, just like every other camp did. But we're going to have a camp that's fun, that has a pool, and that has sports, etc. But we're also going to create a tremendous learning environment in the camp. It's not going to be b'dievet. It's going to be something that's the choshev, that's the ikar of the camp. There was one building in the camp that had air conditioning. The camp had maybe 500 kids in it, and you can imagine how many staff. There was one building with air conditioning, and that was the Beis Medrash. Not the shul, not the dining room, not the staff rooms. The Beis Medrash had air conditioning. That was the only room. In Camp Aguda, with Rebelsky there, you saw the majesty of Torah. You saw the majesty of Torah. And I had never, never experienced that. To see Rav Belsky talking to Rav Ruderman, to see him talking to Rav Gifter, was an unbelievable thing. To see his complete and total hispatlus. He was the Merid Asra. But Rav Ruderman would walk in, Rav Gifter would walk in, others. The complete hispatlus that he had in front of their Torah was an unbelievable thing. This was a person, we couldn't move him an inch. He knew everything. But Rav Gifter walked in the room, he was a nobody. He was an absolute nobody. It was an unbelievable thing to see. When you start a town like Silver Spring, I mean, today I guess you can buy food anywhere, but her, you need a sheichet, and you need a mail, and you need a chazan, and you need somebody who's a baltakeya, you need all kinds of things. Rebelsky did all of those things. I davened in Torah V'Das on Yom Kippur every year when I was younger, and I do remember some Yom Kippurs where he was the Baal Musaf, and we couldn't start on time because he had a bris that day. We started late because he had a bris. There wasn't anything that he couldn't do. There wasn't anything that he couldn't do. Just in terms of history, just for a moment, in terms of the history of American Yiddishkeit, in 1917, there was a Jew named Binyamin Wilhelm who decided to open a yeshiva. They got a bunch of his chaverim together to open a yeshiva, and they called it Torah V'Das. My great-grandfather was the treasurer of Torah V'Das in 1917. He worked with Binyamin Wilhelm. Binyamin Wilhelm had a son-in-law whose name was Beryl Belsky, and Beryl Belsky was in the first class in Torah V'Das, along with some other names you may have heard of. My grandfather was in that class, but names you may have heard of, Rav Pan, and Rav Shor, and Rav Quinn, were all in that class. One of the most amazing classes in the history of yeshivas. And that class built Torah in America. And slowly but surely, each one of those people was fired from Torah V'Das and was sent out to all different yeshivas all over the place. Bachum were thrown out, Balabatim were fired, so that Torah V'Das was the mother of all American yeshivas. Whether it was Telz that was starting, it was Lakewood that was starting, the Bachum were taken from the yeshiva. Mr. Mendelowitz, who ran the yeshiva, threw them out of the yeshiva and had them start other yeshivas. Beryl Belsky himself, actually, with Sandra Lynchner, was also in that class. The two of them went to Radin to learn the Chofetz Chaim for a year. In 1933, they got the Chofetz Chaim all the way to the end. Beryl Belsky came back to America and he got married. He married Binyamin Wilhelm's daughter. And Rav Belsky is his son. I heard one of the sons-in-law say that his father-in-law, once took a three-day vacation. He went to an out-of-the-way place where no one could contact him for 3 days. And he asked his father-in-law when he came back, Rav Belsky, what he did over the 3 days. What did he do over the 3 days? So he said he did Baba Basra over the 3 days. That's what he did. There's another whole aspect of Rav Belsky besides the Kol HaTorah Kula that he was completely subsumed him. Rav Belsky was a tremendous Baal Chesed. I can tell you myself, as a modern boy from Queens, showing up in the Beis Medrash, I won't describe to you how I was dressed. I was not dressed appropriately for the Beis Medrash there. I didn't fit in with the other boys. I was, I believe I had just finished ninth grade. I showed up in the Beis Medrash. I was learning something that day in the Beis Medrash, which wasn't the best thing to be learning in the Beis Medrash that day. I was sitting by myself, and I looked up, and Rav Belsky was sitting in front of me, and he spent the next 45 minutes schmoozing with me, making me comfortable, and making me part of the chevra. That was not a unique story, not at all. That happened all the time. That's what he did. I actually had a cousin who came a couple of years later with me to camp. My cousin used to live in America, moved to Eretz Yisrael, was in a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael called Chorev. It's a Mizrahi yeshiva. He had a big kippah sugah. So I told him if he wants to come with me to Camp Aguda, he really can't wear the kippah sugah. He's going to feel very uncomfortable there. And he put on a hat and a jacket and he came, but he was a Mizrahi boy in Camp Aguda. And he got very close to Rav Belsky. Very close to Rav Belsky. Rav Belsky spent a lot of time with him. And he went back afterwards to Chorev, back to where he came from. And I spoke to him just last night, and I was talking to him about it. Rav Belsky was tremendously makarev. He felt completely comfortable in that setting because of Rav Belsky's efforts. There was a Jew. I don't know if there's anyone in the room who knew him. Maybe somebody knew him. There was a Jew. It was a terrible story. I never knew which parts of the story were entirely true, which parts of the story weren't. But there was a Jew who was a legend. And he used to go around to the various yeshivas, to Lakewood and to other yeshivas. And in the summer, he came to Camp Aguda. There's a Jew, his name was Ramesh Abba Kamyan. Ramesh Abba Kamyan, they said about him that his family had been murdered all at once in the war. Some people even said that it was on his wedding day. I'm not sure if that's correct or not. And Rosh Abba Kamiyad lost his mind. He was clearly a very brilliant person, but he had lost his mind. And he used to sit in the Beis Medrash all day writing letters. I don't know what the letters were about. And we, as kids will do, we sort of picked on him because he was very funny. He was a very cute man and very funny, had a big beard. He was very jovial, very friendly to us. And you knew you'd always get a good answer, always get a good answer from him, whatever you would say. I remember once we asked him about, we saw him reading a Chinese newspaper. So we asked him, Rosh Abba, you know Chinese? Chinese, you know? So he said, no, he doesn't know a word of Chinese. So we asked him, why are you reading a Chinese newspaper? So he said to us, everybody knows when you read a newspaper, it's not what it says that's important, it's reading between the lines. What's an afkamino? What language is written in? That was Rosh Abba Kamiyan. To see the cover that Rebelsky had for Rosh Abba was unbelievable. He sat him next to him, always sat him next to him, always would ask him to start a niggun. He had his own nigunim, he had made up his own nigunim. It was a little funny to hear him sing, but Rebelsky, with a smile on his face, would ask him. The chesed that he performed for that man, I'm sure he knew more of the story than we knew, he didn't tell us. It was an unbelievable thing. Russian Jewry, when they started coming to America, many, many, many Russian Jews ended up in Brooklyn. Russian Jewry just flocked to him. They flocked to him. Men, women, elderly men, elderly women coming to talk to him, talking to him in Yiddish. I could tell you personally that when my Shver Zichron Livracha was very sick, I told him that my Shver wanted me to ask Rebelsky Shilas whenever a Shilas would come up. And I knew a lot of Shilas would come up, that I called Rebelsky and I said that I hope it's okay if I'm going to call sometimes. And he said, you'll do what you have to do. I remember waking him up once, 2:30 in the morning, calling and calling until he would answer the phone, and he answered with a smile, and he answered the questions that, I mean, it was Pekuch Nefesh, I had to ask the questions. But there was nobody, I felt absolutely certain that there was no problem making those phone calls 2:30 in the morning. Absolutely no problem. That's who he was. That's what he wanted. So I want to tell a story that he told us that maybe describes where this midah came from. He told us when he was young, you know, at the Levaya, they said an interesting thing that Rebbe Yabrutny spoke, and he said when he was 18 years old and he was in first year Beis Medrash, Reb Zalig Epstein was the Rebbe in the Shir. Reb Zalig Epstein was the Shashiva of Terev Das, and he was the Rebbe in the Shir. And he got very sick, and he wasn't able to come to say Shir after Pesach. So they brought a 35-year-old young man from Beis Medrash Elyon. Terev Das had another branch in Muncie called Beis Medrash Elyon. They brought him, brought Rebelsky, to say Shirim. And that's the first time he said Shirim in Terev Das. And Rebbe Yabrutny was in that first Shir with a lot of other big people in that Shir at the time. A lot of big lamdanim. And they loved that shir. That was an amazing shir for them. Till they found out many years later that he wasn't 35 at the time, he was 25 at the time. They were 18 and he was 25. And he said a shir for them, and they never knew the difference. It was no problem. No problem. The similar story he told us, that when he was asked to be a counselor in camp, and he was 17 years old, and he was a counselor in camp, and the kids in his bunk were 16. They didn't know he was 17, but he said he had a hard time with them. He had a very difficult time with them because, you know, they weren't too much younger than he was. He had a hard time with them. And he said things finally came to a head on Erev Tisha B'Av. On Erev Tisha B'Av, they served food to the camp, and they put, let's say there were 10 boys in the bunk, plus him is 11, so they had 11 servings on the tray that they put on the table. And each kid took one, and there was one left for him to take, and one of the kids took his hand, stuck his hand out, and picked up the last portion, and stuck it in his own mouth. And Rebelsky didn't have food on Erev Yom Kippur. And that was the last straw. He had been having a terrible summer. It wasn't going well. And Erev Tisha B'Av, he's not going to have food for the fast. He just ran out of the room, and he said he ran into the woods, and he started crying. And he told us that as he sat there crying, he said to himself, it's Erev Tisha B'Av, and I'm crying because I feel sorry for myself. What a waste. It's Erev Tisha B'Av. If I'm already crying, I might as well cry about something important. And he said he cried about the Churban. And he never missed a year, he told us after that, crying about the Churban. That's how a person took personal pain and was able to use that for the klal. Use that for something special. And that's what he was. Whatever he needed for himself wasn't important. That everybody else should feel comfortable around him. That everybody else, a young boy, should feel comfortable in a setting where he's obviously not, doesn't fit exactly, wasn't a problem. Wasn't a problem for him. There's another whole side to Hrabelsky, and that's the more public side of Hrabelsky, which was the as a Persik. Most people are there either Rosh Hashiva or they're a Rav, or a Makariv. Hrabelsky was a Rosh Hashiva and a Persik. But he wasn't just a Persik. People didn't just ask him what bracha do you make on banana chips. It wasn't just that kind of a shiloh, although people did ask him that question. Hrabelsky was a Persik for Klal Yisrael. And his midah was lo saguru mipnei ish. Hrabelsky never cared about what people thought about him. I struggle to even say this, but whenever you tell somebody not to do something, that's when they go ahead and do it. But if you did an internet search on Hrabelsky, which you shouldn't do, you'll see tremendous amount of vitriol, hate for Hrabelsky. Hate. Because Hrabelsky wasn't scared about taking sides. In Shilas of Agunas, in Shilas of Gittin, in Shilas of Molestation, he had no problem taking a side. He got involved. Someone had to get involved, and he did. And he couldn't care less what people thought about him. Did not care. Who's big enough to do that? Over the last 15, 20 years, I'm just going to mention four shilas that were Welt shilas that he was a central cog in deciding. Maybe there are more. There was a major shila about worms and fish. Basically, would have invalidated fish for almost everybody. There was a shiloh about milk from cows. There was a problem with their stomachs. Bugs in water in New York. And shaitels. And if you just think about that for a second, fish, milk, water. Just imagine, Klal Yisrael without those things, or with a very, very difficult time obtaining those things, and the shaitelch for the women. The tshuva that he wrote to Rabbi Yashiv about the sheitach for the women was written immediately when the shayla, when the psak came out from Rabbi Yashiv. David Karliner is supposed to have said that he could also write marachas of Rabbi Kiva Eger. Just you have to give him a few months and he'll be able to write a maracha of Rabbi Kiva Eger. What was special about Rabbi Kiva Eger was that Rabbi Kiva Eger writes that he just got the person's letter this morning and here's the answer. You know, he's going to rush to give an answer and then it's a 24-page maracha. That's what Rabbi Kiva Eger was. Hrabelsky wrote a tshuva in Hilchas Tikrovis Avodah Zarah the next day. Who's holding in those sugyas? Who's holding in the Tosfos from that? Could write a tshuva, a lamdash tshuva, to Rabbi Yashiv. And if you see the answer from Rabbi Yashiv to Hrabelsky, you see the kavod that Rabbi Yashiv has for him. I want to show you just for a second what a pesach is. Because if I asked you, what does a Pesach need to know in order to be a Pesach? Mestami would say Shulchan Aruch. Mestami would say Shas and Peskim. What does a Pesach need to know? How about Chumash? Does a Pesach need to know Chumash? I heard of Hrabelsky being asked once whether someone is allowed to copy a music or a shir or whatever it is off somebody else's CD. At the time, he was talking about CDs. So can you copy it? If somebody buys a CD, can you copy their CD without paying for it? And Rav Belsky said it's an issa d'oraisa. It's an issa d'oraisa. Someone went ahead and put a tremendous amount of effort into putting music onto a CD. He either composed the music or he sang the music, whatever it is. It's his property. He put the efforts in. And now you want to take it away from him without paying for it. It's an issa d'oraisa. So the person asked him, Where does it say in the Torah that it's issa d'oraisa? So Rav Belsky said, it's a pasuk in the Teichacha. It's where we all would have looked. Pasuk in Parshas Kisavo. Pasuk says, Priyat Moscha v'chol yigiyacha. Everything you've worked for. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu telling us what will happen, Chas v'Shalom, if you don't listen to the mitzvahs. Yoichal am ach asher lo yadata. Other people will eat. Vayiso rak oshuk v'rotutz kol hayomim. And you'll be oshuk, you'll be oppressed and rotzutz and smashed all those days. So if someone takes away all of the energy, all of the efforts that you've put into something, and someone takes it from you, you're oshuk and you're rotzutz. What does that make that person? He's the person who's doing the oshuk, the ritzitza. So if you take that from a person, would you like to be called that? It's a first pasuk in the Torah. It's a pasuk from a pasuk in Chumash. Paskin Halacha said it's a din d'oraisa. I just want to finish with one last story, and then maybe the lessons from the story. When Rav Belsky was very young, the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Das was Reb Reuven. Reb Reuven Grozovsky was the son-in-law of Reb Baruch Ber. America saw the son-in-law of Reb Baruch Ber to be Rosh Yeshiva in America. It was unbelievable. And Reb Reuven got old, and they decided that they're going to start, Reb Reuven need to get out of the city, and they decided that they're going to start Beis Medrash Elyon, which was in Muncie. At the time, Muncie was middle of nowhere, middle of a forest. There was nothing there. And Reb Reuven moved there, and they started Beis Medrash Elyon. Reb Belsky described to us what it was like on, I believe it was Simchas Torah, it might have been Shavuos, about how they picked up Reb Reuven on a chair and they carried him through the woods with his talis over his head, Zilbana Torah, and the Bachrim danced around him, and the majesty of Torah, the majesty of Torah. But Reb Belsky was in his younger teens at the time, 14 or 15 years old at the time. And there was a day, it was his turn to be Mishamish Reb Reuven. And Reb Reuven was already not well, and he was mostly paralyzed. I don't remember the details of the story entirely, and I'm sorry I don't. But as far as I can recall, Reb Reuven was wearing his tefillin, and something happened. Maybe they had forgotten to wash his hands, or maybe, I don't know, maybe he touched something that he had to wash his hands, and he needed to wash his hands. Reb Reuven was lying down, wearing his tefillin. And he asked Reb Belsky to bring, he motioned to him that he needs to wash his hands. So Reb Belsky brought some water and a shizel and washed his hands. And as he brought the water over, he tripped. This is a 14-year-old bacher, he tripped. And he knocked over the entire pitcher of water onto Reb Reuven, all over him. Everywhere, all over his clothing, all over the bed, everywhere. And he told us he never was more mortified in his whole life. Nothing ever came close to that. That he did that to Reb Reuven. And he said Reb Reuven spent the next 15 minutes schmoozing with him and talking to him and telling him not to worry about it and asking him about who he was and where he was from and what, you know, about talking to him. Anyway, he cleaned up everything and okay. Afterwards, a few days later, he told people that the story that had happened, he was very embarrassed. They didn't say it right away, but he told people the story that had happened. And they told him that he was a liar. That's an impossible story. Couldn't have happened. So he said, why would you call me a liar? So he said, because Reb Reuven never in history ever talked with his tefillin on. We know that you're lying because Reb Reuven never talked with his tefillin on. So it can't be that story happened. Reb Belsky said it did happen. it did happen. Now look how many things you learn from that story. You learn the majesty of Torah, who Reb Reuven was. You learn the place of a chumrah in the face of Ben Adam L'Chaver. You learn what chesed is. You learn how an Adam Gadol has an instantaneous decision that whatever it is that's dear to him is not important. It's not important in the face of a 14-year-old boy who's in pain. It's not negeah. That's what Rebelsky was the rest of his life. That's what he was. When Rebelsky finished high school in New York, if you got into college, it was free. Tuition was free in college. The thing was, in order to get into Brooklyn College or Queens College at the time, you needed to have a 90 average in high school. Rebelsky won a Regents Fellowship when he finished high school. Regents Fellowship meant, of course, free tuition in school. Anybody who got in had free tuition. But it also meant $2,000 a year. I don't know exactly what year, 55, 56, something like that. $2,000 a year to help pay for lodging and food. Somebody who won a similar scholarship in the late 60s told me that he won $3,000 a year and that he had nothing to spend the money on. There was no way for him to spend all of that money. It was impossible. A single person to spend all that money. Anyway, Rebelsky deferred it for a year because he wanted to sit and learn. At the end of the year, they came back to him and they said that they wanted to give him that fellowship again, and he deferred it for a second year. At the end of the second year, they came back to him again, and they told him that if he doesn't take it now, he's not getting it. And he didn't take it. Somebody told me just today that he remembered Rebelsky as a young Pirche leader, that he used to play ping pong with the boys in Pirche, and he used to give them a 19-point advantage before they started, and he never lost a game. I can tell you that I played paddleball with him. I never saw him lose. He was a prolific swimmer. He was athletic. Rebelsky is an American Gadol. Any one of us could be Rebelsky. We don't have his IQ, that's correct. We don't have his Kerech HaZikaron. We don't have his interest in everything. We don't have that. But he's exactly where we are. He could have gone to school. He could have become a tremendous person. He just gave it all up. He gave it all up to sit and learn. And by doing that, he became the Pesach for America. He became the Rosh Hashiva of a yeshiva. He was made a mapecha in the summer camps. A mapecha, absolutely. And any one of us could be that. He's the Gadol for America. And that's an unbelievable thing. Yizkor Baruch.